Did you get any? What did you do with it? Do you think it worked? I'm talking about the cash handouts the government forked over in order to stimulate the economy. And certainly something's gone right, so much so that apparently the Reserve Bank's worried about inflation again and considering a Melbourne Cup Day interest rate rise. But was it the container loads of cash? ANU economist Andrew Lee, our regular Ryside economics commentator, has been tracking the money and he joins me now. Hi, Andrew.
G'day, Richard.
Remind us how much we were all given.
Well, there was a couple of different packages. The one in December of last year focused on pensioners and families receiving family tax benefit Part A, which is about two-thirds of families. Single pensioners, $1,400. Pensioner couples, $2,100. And then there was a certain amount per child on family tax benefit A. And then there was another set of payments that came out between March and May of this year. The one that I think sticks in everyone's mind is the $900 for people with taxable incomes below $80,000. And then there was a per-child payment for anyone with school-aged kids, again, on the family tax benefit A, $950 a kid. That's, of course, just the headline things. There's a bunch of smaller payments, but they're the main ones.
So how much does it all add up to?
Well, last year's payments are about $9 billion, and this year's payments are about $12 billion. So $21 billion, or a couple of percent of annual GDP.
That is real money.
Certainly is. Yeah. You could build a lot of schools, you could transform a lot of hospitals, you could do a major policy reform in whatever area you pick, maybe except defence.
Except for defence,
using that kind of money.
And did people spend it as the Prime Minister urged them to, or save it as Malcolm Turnbull predicted they would?
Well, ANU put a survey into the field about a month after the last payments went out, and we basically asked people, what did you do with the cash, focusing on those who received it? And we got an answer that about 40% of respondents said they'd spent it. And if you believe evidence from overseas, that's more households will continue to spend in the following quarter. So my best guess is somewhere between 40 and 70% of Australian households spent the cash, which I think is a reasonable result. You never expect everybody to actually spend it. Some people are going to put it in the bank. But it's not a bad place to start.
Now, we spent more of ours than the Americans spent of theirs, didn't we?
This is the thing that surprised me. So when I look back to similar surveys that have been done of US payments, which went out in 2001, that's the time when they had a recession, we didn't really have the same downturn. And then 2008, there was another payment sent out by George Bush. Only about 20% of American households spent their cash. And this was a bit of a puzzle to me. My best guess as to why we spent at a much greater rate than Americans, or if you like, why Australians are more easily stimulated than Americans, is that our payments were called bonus payments and the American payments were called rebates. And there's a little bit of sort of interesting experimental economics research that suggests that if you call something a bonus, people say, oh, wow, that's something I wouldn't have expected to get otherwise. Well, I'd better go out and spend it. If you call something a rebate, people say, well, that's just putting me back where I would have been otherwise. So I'll just put it in the bank.
That's like finding $20 in your pocket that you didn't know about.
You probably don't think,
I must put that in the piggy bank. You think, oh, I'll go out for lunch.
Exactly. And you might think of a rebate as you've been looking around the house to find that $20 note and you finally find it and you put it back in your wallet and there you are.
Mm. In your survey, you also looked at who the spenders were as opposed to who the savers were.
Absolutely. This is one of the nice things you can do with a survey. You get some sort of reasonably predictable patterns. Those who are worried about government debt in the future are more likely to put the money in the bank. There's this economic theory called Ricardian equivalence, which basically says that taxpayers are always thinking about government debt whenever they receive payments. And that
Who does that, really?
So it turns out that something like a quarter of our respondents seem to do that. So these are people who are very worried about government debt, and when they hear bonus payment now, they immediately say, well, what the government really means is it's going to raise my taxes next year. So I'd better put the money in the bank to hold it for next year. But in practice, that turns out not to be the typical respondent. A lot of people are cash constrained. You know, otherwise, we wouldn't see these spikes in spending on payroll days and are more inclined to spend money when they receive it rather than to think in terms of a sort of life cycle model in which they're worried about government debt. So if you're worried about government debt, you're less likely to spend it. If you're worried about personal unemployment, yourself losing a job or someone in your household losing a job, you're again less likely to spend the money. So that suggests that actually, if you want to stimulate the economy, you probably shouldn't be giving money to those who are most at risk of losing their job. There might be other reasons why you want to give money to those people, but stimulating the economy isn't a good reason for giving money to those groups.
You also looked at whether people were Labour or Coalition voters, though, didn't you?
So this is one of the most intriguing findings. There seems to be a real sort of commitment by Labour voters to go out there and spend it. And that's not just because they're different ages or different incomes from Coalition voters. We can hold all that constant. And it still turns out that Labour voters are more likely to spend the money than Coalition voters. About twice as likely, actually. In fact, the best predictor in the survey of whether somebody goes out and spends the money is how would you vote if an election were held today? You can throw around some theories for this. One is that Labour voters do what Kevin Rudd tells them and Coalition voters do what Malcolm Turnbull tells them. Or maybe the Labour voters were just more optimistic about the state of the economy and so therefore had a greater propensity to spend and were less worried that a deep downturn was on its way.
Right. OK. On Life Matters, my guest is Andrew Lee, who's a Professor of Economics at the ANU and our regular Ryeside Economics commentator. We have him every couple of weeks. Could it be, Andrew, that Labour voters are less in tune with the financial crisis or with political issues?
It could entirely. So you could, if you were a hardline conservative looking at these results, you'd say, well, we know that Labour voters are just systematically ill-informed and make a lot of stupid decisions. But actually, there's a teeny bit of evidence out of political science that suggests it might be around the other way. So if you ask questions like, who was Pig Iron Bob? Who was the Prime Minister before John Howard? How long is the election term? The kinds of people that get those questions right are actually more likely to be Labour voters than Coalition voters. If only informed people voted, then Labour majority would be slightly higher. So I'm less inclined to go with the theory that Labour voters are worse informed about the economy than Coalition voters.
Well, okay. Can we say then whether the cash handouts have indeed been good for the economy and helped in the recovery?
Certainly the results of the ANU poll seem to suggest that they played a part. When you're putting together a fiscal stimulus package, you're kind of trying to weigh up these two big items that you can spend on. You can either give out cash handouts, where you know that a dollar of cash handouts probably won't produce a full dollar of economic activity because people will save it, but it's quick. Or else you can do infrastructure, which you know is likely to produce, a dollar of infrastructure will produce more than a dollar of economic activity, but it's slow. And so I think the balance of the package is probably basically right. In retrospect, it probably looks a little bit too big. But if you want to make a mistake in putting together a fiscal policy package, you want to make the mistake where you make it too big rather than too small, because deep recessions have this awful scarring effect, as you know, on the unemployment and the life chances of young people graduating from school. So you really don't want to get it wrong on that side.
So if you are the government, you have a tendency to have the sort of shock and awe response rather than not going in hard enough.
That's absolutely right, and that's certainly the lesson out of the Great Depression. If we could go back there into when these policies were put together, knowing what we know now, we'd make them smaller. But you've got to judge policy based on what was known at the time the policy was drawn together.
All right. So you've mentioned infrastructure. That, of course, is the other part of the response to the economic crisis. Is it, I suppose, too early to know what the impact of the infrastructure spending will be?
Yeah, I haven't seen any careful analyses of the infrastructure spending. It seems that they've had an impact. I mean, just talking to people in the construction industry and the architecture industry, they certainly seem to be having a lot more work than they feel they would normally have in the previous downturn. But it's going to be a little while before we get sort of good estimates out of that. One way you could think about estimating that is to look at what's happened to construction work in areas with lots of schools and areas without a lot of schools, given that schools have been the main site for the infrastructure spending. Mm. But I haven't seen anyone who's done that yet.
Because there have been calls, the opposition has been calling to kind of wind back the stimulus, perhaps to stop spending money now that the economy is showing signs of improvement. I know you've been through Senate committees of inquiry where you had to give evidence. What do you think of the opposition's position?
So my view when the senators asked me about this was that governments should be pretty reluctant about breaking promises, that there's both a political cost and potentially also an economic cost of breaking promises. The more that voters think, well, they can't be trusted, they're all the same, they'll say one thing and then they'll do something else a year later, that degrades the ability of government to function effectively, I think. And also economically, if you expect that the government is going to break its promise, you're less likely to make investments. So a lot of small businesses, for example, have re-geared around being providing insulation. And those small business owners, I think, have some reasonable right to expect that the government will stick to its word.
All right. Andrew, finally, and just briefly, I can't let you go without asking about the significance of Eleanor Ostrom, who's the first female winner of the Nobel Prize for Economics. What's been her contribution?
Well, Richard, I think the thing that's shocked economists more than the fact that she's the first woman to win the Nobel is that she's the first political scientist to win the Nobel. So a couple of years ago, we gave it to Danny Kahneman, a psychologist. Now we're giving it to political scientists. In some sense, it's economics being this broad, overarching social science, which is encompassing others, kind of the sorts of things we've talked about. Mm. Eleanor Ostrom has done work looking at a thing that's been called the tragedy of the commons. This is the idea that if you have a common resource, such as, for example, a green area in the middle of a village where people graze their animals, or a forest which people might use to walk in, but also to harvest wood, that those things are subject to all kinds of problems because people have an incentive to overgraze the commons and to overuse the wood from the forest. It actually turns out, though, according to Eleanor Ostrom's work, that we don't necessarily need to worry about this as much as theory would suggest. That in practice, it turns out that communities find their own ways of setting up rules to manage the commons, or of punishing those who overgraze or over-remove too much wood from the forest. And she's done a lot of extraordinary, careful work using satellite imagery, interviews with communities and so on, really carefully measuring how the sets of rules that evolve to manage commons areas. And in some sense, rejecting the idea that you either have to have government take it over or you have to privatise the commons, which I think is where economics was before Eleanor Ostrom came along.
It sounds like, though, that this is scale dependent, that this works best in a community that of up to a certain size. Otherwise, we could take this approach to things like water, which we all own now and which we haven't been managing very well.
That's absolutely right, and I think the contribution that Ostrom makes is saying that we need to think about the way in which the local rules have evolved and whether those local rules are sustainable. We shouldn't necessarily assume that a community can put together an army by itself and therefore that we don't need to raise taxes to fund national defence. But we might be more reluctant to say that a local park needs to be fully centrally managed rather than having locals working out the rules of access and the times at which can be reasonably used and that kind of thing.
Andrew, it's always really interesting. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Richard.
Andrew Lee's Professor of Economics at the ANU, and we'll have more Ryside in a couple of weeks.